the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We're in day 20 of the partial government shutdown. It's the second longest in U.S. history, and if it goes until Saturday, it'll be number one. We'll ask Congresswoman Katie Hill what, if anything, there is to compromise on, plus how the shutdown is coming down on air traffic controllers.
It's added frustration, anxiety, and more stress to already a stressful life.
It's all ahead on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Whether it's a wall or a fence constructed from steel or from concrete, President Trump's proposed border barrier is all anyone seems to be talking about these days. And even though the border is miles away from Los Angeles, the proposed wall is looming large, having ripple effects on many people here in Southern California. Coming up, we'll speak with a local air traffic controller to find out how he's doing 3 weeks into the partial federal government shutdown. Air traffic controllers are considered essential workers and obligated to work, even though they are not getting paid. We'll also look ahead to the first state budget proposal from our newly sworn-in Governor Gavin Newsom. How much money will be allocated for education and for wildlife funding? We've got all those details. First, though, the political stalemate continues as Democrats refuse to fund President Trump's border wall. In Washington Wednesday, one short meeting.
He sort of slammed the table, and when Leader Pelosi said she didn't agree with the wall, he just walked out and said, "We have nothing to discuss."
With two different sides.
Well, the president walked into the room and passed out candy. I don't recall him ever raising his voice or slamming his hand.
It all adds up to no progress. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Vice President Mike Pence there. This morning, President Trump says he could circumvent Congress to get the wall.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will.
But he says the word compromise is in his vocabulary. Federal employees could start feeling the pinch tomorrow when they don't receive their usual paychecks. And that includes many in Congressional District 25 in northern L.A. County, where aerospace is king. Industry workers and contractors packed a town hall in Palmdale on Sunday, hosted by their new representative, Katie Hill. Congresswoman Hill joins us now from a labor rally in Washington. Congresswoman, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's start by just helping people understand how big a problem this shutdown is for people living and working in your district. What industries are affected and how many people?
So, as you mentioned, aerospace is huge in our district. We also have a large federal prison right outside of our district. So many of the employees, the prison guards, live in our district and commute. And, you know, it's a high-security prison. It literally protects us from terrorists. And so these folks are having to go into work without pay. Their leave has been canceled. They are unable to take their kids into medical visits. They're having to choose whether they're going to pay their rent or they're going to pay for, you know, in many cases, medical bills. And it's absolutely devastating, people. They're, you know, my office has gotten nonstop calls just telling the stories of people who are, you know, air traffic controllers, FBI agents. I mean, the whole gamut of federal workers. That are just terrified.
Now, you spent your third day on the job, not in D.C. You could have been there the whole weekend, but you spent it in Palmdale, in your district. You hosted a town hall. You heard directly from those affected by the shutdown. What are some of the stories that struck you?
The one that really crushed me was John, one of our prison workers, who told us about how he and so many of the guards are picking up second jobs as Uber drivers. Working night shifts after they've done their day jobs or all-night jobs, depending on how their shifts go, because they are having to work, you know, 18, 20 hours a day just to be able to pay the bills. And it's unacceptable. There's no other sector in which any employer can get away with forcing people to work without pay. And it should be illegal for the government to do so as well.
Talking to Congresswoman Katie Hill. She represents California's 25th district in northern L.A. County. Now, it's been reported that you face questions about President Trump's desired border wall. I'll ask you the same question I've asked your colleagues, Katie Porter and Adam Schiff, this week, and that is, what are you willing to compromise on to get this budget deal passed?
So as far as I'm concerned, this isn't about compromise. This isn't about the negotiation. This is about us opening the government. And this is a complete failure of our government, of our legislature. And, you know, at this point, it's really sitting with President Trump. We, on the House side, have passed the legislation, multiple different variations of it, that the Senate has passed overwhelmingly, and would pass again if Mitch McConnell would let it come to a vote. And then it would be up to the president. So I want to introduce some legislation. I'm going to be working with our partners in labor to make it impossible for this to happen again. And we will come to the table. We have a comprehensive immigration reform that we want to pass, and that includes border security. So that's where the negotiation should happen, but it should not be at the expense of federal workers.
So we're really at a point, Congresswoman, when there is no room for compromise anymore?
No, I think there's the compromise should, again, come not at the, on the backs of federal workers. And so right now, I think what we're seeing is there's no way out of this that President Trump is finding. He's going to find some way out of it. I have a feeling that he'll probably end up realizing that this is impossible for him. He's going to keep getting the pressure from, again, Border Patrol. The Border Patrol agents that he says that he's with are not getting paid. They're going to miss their first paychecks tomorrow. And I think he's going to feel the pressure. We need to continue to put the pressure on the Senate. And then he will have to end up saying he's going to declare his state of emergency, which will get shot down in court. And we can get the government open again. And then we'll continue the fight in terms of how we should best do border security and what immigration reform looks like. But I really think that the priority for us needs to be that we cannot have these shutdowns. We cannot use this as a bargaining chip. This is completely unethical and should be illegal for us to hold people's lives hostage.
So that's the only path you see for the president to go that route, to declare the emergency?
I do. I really do. Unless he's called something else his border wall, but I just don't see that happening right now. I think that he's going to have to go. He's going to have to skirt it.
For the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We're in day 20 of the partial government shutdown. It's the second longest in U.S. history, and if it goes until Saturday, it'll be number one. We'll ask Congresswoman Katie Hill what, if anything, there is to compromise on, plus how the shutdown is coming down on air traffic controllers.
It's added frustration, anxiety, and more stress to already a stressful life.
It's all ahead on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Whether it's a wall or a fence constructed from steel or from concrete, President Trump's proposed border barrier is all anyone seems to be talking about these days. And even though the border is miles away from Los Angeles, the proposed wall is looming large, having ripple effects on many people here in Southern California. Coming up, we'll speak with a local air traffic controller to find out how he's doing 3 weeks into the partial federal government shutdown. Air traffic controllers are considered essential workers and obligated to work even though they are not getting paid. We'll also look ahead to the first state budget proposal from our newly sworn-in Governor Gavin Newsom. How much money will be allocated for education and for wildlife funding? We've got all those details. First, though, the political stalemate continues as Democrats refuse to fund President Trump's border wall. In Washington Wednesday, one short meeting.
He sort of slammed the table, and when Leader Pelosi said she didn't agree with the wall, he just walked out and said, "We have nothing to discuss."
With two different sides.
Well, the president walked into the room and passed out candy. I don't recall him ever raising his voice or slamming his hand.
It all adds up to no progress. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Vice President Mike Pence there. This morning, President Trump says he could circumvent Congress to get the wall.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will.
But he says the word compromise is in his vocabulary. Federal employees could start feeling the pinch tomorrow when they don't receive their usual paychecks. And that includes many in Congressional District 25 in northern L.A. County, where aerospace is king. Industry workers and contractors packed a town hall in Palmdale on Sunday, hosted by their new representative, Katie Hill. Congresswoman Hill joins us now from a labor rally in Washington. Congresswoman, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's start by just helping people understand how big a problem this shutdown is for people living and working in your district. What industries are affected and how many people?
So as you mentioned, aerospace is huge in our district. We also have a large federal prison right outside of our district. So many of the employees, the prison guards, live in our districts and commute. And, you know, it's a high security prison. It literally protects us from terrorists. And so these folks are having to go into work, work without pay. Their leave has been canceled. They are unable to take their kids into medical visits. They're having to choose whether they're going to pay their rent or they're going to pay for, you know, in many cases, medical bills. And it's absolutely devastating, people. My office has gotten nonstop calls just telling the stories of people who are, you know, air traffic controllers, FBI agents, I mean, the whole gamut of federal workers that are just terrified.
Now, you spent your third day on the job, not in D.C. You could have been there the whole weekend, but you spent it in Palmdale, in your district. You hosted a town hall. You heard directly from those affected by the shutdown. What are some of the stories that struck you?
The one that really crushed me was John, one of our prison workers, who told us about how he and so many of the guards are picking up second jobs as Uber drivers, working night shifts after they've done their day jobs or night jobs, depending on how their shifts go, because they are having to work, you know, 18, 20 hours a day just to be able to pay the bills. And it's unacceptable. There's no other sector in which any employer can get away with forcing people to work without pay. And it should be illegal for the government to do so as well.
Talking to Congresswoman Katie Hill, she represents California's 25th district in northern LA County. Now, it's been reported that you face questions about President Trump's desired border wall. I'll ask you the same question I've asked your colleagues, Katie Porter and Adam Schiff, this week, and that is, what are you willing to compromise on to get this budget deal passed?
So as far as I'm concerned, this isn't about compromise. This isn't about the negotiation. This is about us opening the government, and this is a complete failure of our government, of our legislature. And, you know, at this point, it's really sitting with President Trump. We, on the House side, have passed the legislation, multiple different variations of it, that the Senate has passed overwhelmingly, and would pass again if Mitch McConnell would let it come to a vote, and then it would be up to the president. So I want to introduce some legislation. I'm going to be working with our partners in labor to make it impossible for this to happen again. And we will come to the table. We have comprehensive immigration reform that we want to pass, and that includes border security. So that's where the negotiation should happen, but it should not be at the expense of federal workers.
So we're really at a point, Congresswoman, when there is no room for compromise anymore?
No, I think there's the compromise should, again, come not on the backs of federal workers. And so right now, I think what we're seeing is there's no way out of this that President Trump is finding. He's going to find some way out of it. I have a feeling that he'll probably end up realizing that this is impossible for him. He's going to keep getting the pressure from, again, Border Patrol. The Border Patrol agents that he says that he's with are not getting paid. They're going to miss their first paychecks tomorrow. And I think he's going to feel the pressure. We need to continue to put the pressure on the Senate. And then he will have to end up saying he's going to declare his state of emergency, which will get shot down in court. And we can get the government open again. And then we'll continue the fight in terms of how we should best do border security and what immigration reform looks like. But I really think that the priority for us needs to be that we cannot have these shutdowns. We cannot use this as a bargaining chip. This is completely unethical and should be illegal for us to hold people's lives hostage.
So that's the only path you see for the president to go that route, to declare the emergency?
I do. I really do. Unless he's called something else, his border wall, but I just don't see that happening right now. I think that he's going to have to skirt it some way to be able to save face with his base. And we need to make sure that people know that that's exactly what he's doing.
I got to ask, though, given the huge impact this shutdown is having on your district, are you inclined to maybe give them some funding, something to get people paid and back to work?
No, because this is if we give him something right now, it's like giving a kid a candy bar who's throwing a tantrum in a store, then they're just going to keep doing it. And he's done it three times this past year. He will keep doing it. $5 billion is just the beginning of what he wants for this border wall, and he will continue to do it, and we can't risk that. So it means that we have to force his hand to back out of this. We have to make it impossible for him to do it in the future, and we need him to figure out some other way of being able to fight for what it is that he wants, just like it should be in politics.
Your district, Congresswoman, is pretty purple politically. Is there any worry in your mind that if this shutdown continues, it could hurt your relationship with Republicans in the future in your district?
Well, I was concerned about that at first, and frankly, I was expecting at my town hall to get a lot of pushback around it. But, you know, I said exactly what I'm telling you right now, which is that the priority has to be on opening the government. And it's frankly a moral stance that we need to take in terms of who we are, how we treat our workers, the people who are supposed to be protecting us, is in many cases is law enforcement professionals, many of whom are Republicans, and they're the ones that are not getting paid. So I have not found that to be the case because, and so of all the people who came to the town hall, I had two who asked questions and that were skewing towards wanting the wall. The rest were just wanting to get paid, and they were recognizing that Trump was in the wrong and that we need to be pushing the Senate Republicans to make this happen.
Katie Hill represents California's 25th district in northern L.A. County. Congresswoman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's hear from another group of people affected by the government shutdown. That's air traffic controllers. If you've ever landed safely at an airport, you have them to thank. And while the nation's controllers are no stranger to stress, many are feeling some anxiety as payday approaches, especially those living in pricey Southern California. And their concerns don't end just there. Alex Cisneros is with us now. He handles takeoffs and arrivals at airports across Southern California. Think LAX, Ontario, and Van Nuys. He's also representative for the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. That union covers around 20,000 workers across the country. Alex, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Now, Alex, this shutdown affects controllers just like you on both a personal and professional level. So let's start with the personal side of this. It's day 20 of the shutdown, just one day short of the record. Air traffic controllers are deemed essential employees, so you're all working. How are you and your colleagues feeling right now?
That's absolutely the case. We've been here since day one of the furloughs and the shutdown. We've been providing a service for the National Airspace System, uninterrupted, out of sight, out of mind, really. And that's what we expect. We want everything to just run seamless. But the anxiety and the frustration is starting to build, especially as we get closer to payday, mm-hmm. which is next Tuesday. Things are starting to become a little more real on the human side. It's added frustration, anxiety, and more stress to already a stressful life as air traffic controllers.
What kind of conversations are you having up in that tower, if you even have time to have these kind of conversations with the job you do?
You know, as the union representative for the National Air Traffic Controllers, I feel a lot of those questions. I feel uncertainty. A lot of the people come to me looking for answers as simple as, hey, if we don't get paid, is my medical coverage going to continue? I took out a loan for my 401k. Will I be in default? If I can't make a mortgage payment, what do you think I should do? And as we've gotten closer, I think that the number of questions I've had to take in the last couple of days has definitely increased. So it's definitely taken a toll in our membership.
How much of a concern is there that some of your colleagues might not be able to make ends meet?
You know, it's definitely a concern. It's definitely a concern. I had an employee come to me late last week. I was going back and forth with him, and he was asking me, he's like, if I'm on furlough, because there's certain employees that aren't coming into work, that mm-hmm. aren't deemed essential. He asked me if it was all right if he delivered pizza on the side to ensure that he had some money coming in case he isn't paid as a furloughed employee. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's something that's in most controllers' minds.
Talking to Alex Cisneros. He's a representative for the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. All right, let's look at the professional effects of this shutdown. There are two big ones, right?
Absolutely. Like you mentioned, this problem is twofold. There's the human aspect, but there's also the aspect of modernization and the staffing. The National Airspace System is a complex system. We've been in the process of modernizing for the last few years. We're shifting from a ground-based radar system
to a GPS and satellite-based system, but that's a long process. It takes hundreds of people, engineers, contractors, air traffic controllers, people from management in the Federal Aviation Administration, in order to bring a project like this to fruition. And unfortunately, every time we have a shutdown, that project is stalled. There's hundreds, if not thousands of people that are working on this that are not able to keep this project going. There was a perfect analogy. It's like a freight train. It takes a long time to build up the speed, and it takes a long time to bring it back down to zero. But when it comes to a screeching halt, before we start up again, it's going to take a long, long time. Even though it's been a three-week shutdown, if it goes any longer, we're adding months and months to the total timeline, and that's millions and millions of dollars that are going to waste.
And what about the staffing?
Absolutely. We're at a 30-year low for air traffic controllers across the country. There's approximately 10,500 certified controllers that are operating the National Airspace System. Training to become an air traffic controller is a long and complex process. As you can imagine, we're a job or a profession that has zero room for error. So when people are directing and separating aircraft, we want them to absolutely be ready. So that process is stopped. The schoolhouse and the academy that we have in Oklahoma City is shuttered. Every employee that was going through that process is back at their facility or back at their home waiting for the furloughs to end so they can start this process. The last time this happened in 2013, it took us approximately 2 to 3 years to reach our hiring goals just because of the delays in the furloughs and the shutdown.
Alex, if someone is listening to this right now and is thinking, man, you know, maybe I don't take the flight to go visit my parents, or I don't take that flight to go on a business trip because I don't want the risk that these men and women who are in charge of my safety, that they're being so stressed out by possibly not getting paid that maybe they don't do their job as well as they could. What would you say to those people right now?
I would tell them that they have absolutely nothing to worry about. We're consummate professionals. We come to work ready and dedicated to serve the National Airspace System. We run the safest and busiest National Airspace System in the world, and we will continue to do so. We have a deep commitment to this country. A lot of us are veterans. We're patriotic, but that's something that the American public should not worry about. Their safety is not compromised. However, I would ask them to reach out to the legislators and tell them, hey, air traffic controllers and other government employees, they provide a valuable service to our country and to our economy. Let's pay them. Let's get the support staff that's not here now back to work. We need them. We need them to be a part of our system and to keep the trends of safety that we have now continuing.
Alex Cisneros is an air traffic controller. He handles takeoffs and arrivals at airports across Southern California. Alex, thanks a lot for making the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've got our eyes and ears on the potential teacher strike here in Los Angeles. Coming up, we'll have the very latest on that. Also, in the past few years, you may have noticed how diverse California's teachers have become. It's no accident, done by design. Find out how and why California's kids are benefiting. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. So far, there's no resolution between Los Angeles Unified School District and the union that represents its teachers. The strike date has now been moved to Monday the 14th. But that could be pushed back even further. The two sides are back in court this morning. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is headed back there in a matter of minutes to get the very latest and send us this report.
Essentially, what LAUSD is going to argue in court today, within the hour, is that they're going to ask a judge to delay the strike even further than Monday. They believe that the union essentially botched some of the legal technicalities of declaring this strike far beyond some of the issues that we've known about so far. We'll have to see how those arguments land with a judge. So, still more uncertainty over the strike date if negotiations fail.
The other big news is that yesterday, the Los Angeles County Office of Education assigned a team of fiscal experts to assess the school district's finances.
The assignment of something called a fiscal expert may not sound like much, but it is a serious step. The next step on the ladder of the county's interventions is something like a takeover, the appointment of an official who can invalidate the decisions of the school board, overturn school board decisions, rewrite budgets, has a lot of power. And so LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner yesterday said, we don't think that that's what is happening here, that this isn't some direct precursor, but it also is an indication of just how concerned the county is about the district's finances.
The union, according to Kyle, expressed some suspicion over the timing of this announcement, but the two sides will be back at the negotiating table tomorrow. News about a likely teacher strike in the LA Unified School District has dominated our education coverage here at KPCC, but according to some new statistics from the California Department of Education, there is some good news. Over the last 7 years, the state's teachers have become more diverse. For details on the benefits of a more representative teaching workforce and what it can mean for students, we have Pedro Noguera. He's faculty director at UCLA Center for the Transformation of Schools. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, give us a sense of what the teacher workforce used to be, say, 10 years ago.
Well, nationally still, it's overwhelmingly white and female. And that's still pretty much the case in most parts of the country. We're starting to see some urban districts that are changing the demographics, and a greater number of African-American, Latino, Asian teachers are entering the profession. And so the makeup of the teaching force is beginning to more closely resemble that of the student population.
What about in Los Angeles, LAUSD specifically?
LA, I think, has made tremendous strides in this area. I know in several of the schools that I work with throughout the city, the staff is very diverse. And what that means is there are people on staff who live in the communities where the children live, who speak the language they speak, who understand what their lives are like outside of school, and it's a huge asset.
Why was there such a lack of diversity before?
I think that for historic reasons, people of color have not seen teacher profession as a real strong, viable option. The salaries are not high, and the status of teachers is not great in many parts of the country. And that's true for everyone. But I think particularly for people who had negative experiences in school, the idea of becoming a teacher has not been that attractive. So we're starting to see a change there, and that, I think, is a great sign.
Yeah, why is this shift happening?
I think it's really about recruitment and about trying to reach students early, even as early as high school, and encouraging them to see teaching as a viable avenue to work in. And we're seeing universities are doing that now also with undergraduates, and it does make a difference. And when students have a chance to work in schools and assist teachers, then they get to see, understand the work, and also see its many benefits and joys.
And how does that recruitment work? Because I would imagine if there are students who are bilingual, that maybe they would be the ones that are targeted to at least know about the possibility of becoming a teacher.
Well, the best recruitment programs start even while kids are in middle or high school. And you find kids who are naturally drawn to working with other students as tutors. And there are schools that have now formed even future teacher associations. And that gets it in their heads that teaching could be a great area to work in. And when they get to see excellent teachers at work, it's even more inspiring to know that you can really make a difference through teaching.
Talking to Pedro Noguera, he's faculty director at UCLA Center for the Transformation of Schools. Now, when it comes to the implications, Pedro, of a more representative teaching corps, what are those implications? What's the research out there about this?
Well, the research is pretty strong. There was a study done at Johns Hopkins about a year ago, and what was important about the study was a quantitative study, and it just looked at a big data set, and the questions they were asking is, what difference does it make with respect to achievement and with respect to discipline patterns when there are minority teachers working with kids? And what they found is that both minority and non-minority students benefited. And that tells us a lot about why it is essential, not just for children of color, but for white students as well, to have access to highly trained teachers from diverse backgrounds, because it really does change their outlook on what they think is possible in this country. It breaks stereotypes, and it opens doors into other opportunities.
Pedro, how do role models that reflect the student body help students learn?
As some people recall the name Jaime Escalante. Jaime Escalante
sure,
was this brilliant math teacher, engineer originally, who taught at Garfield High School, had the nerve to believe that his kids, the children of factory workers, most of whom are immigrant, could do calculus.
Yeah. Stand and Deliver was the movie, Edward James Olmos.
Stand and Deliver, still a great movie.
Yeah.
And as we know, for 19 years in a row, his kids took and passed that advanced placement calculus exam. Well, recently I met one of his former students. She's an engineer, the only Latina engineer in Southern California working for a major aeronautics firm. And I asked her, how did you get into this field? She said, I was a student of Escalante's. And it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here. And because of him, I give back by working as a volunteer, teaching kids robotics on weekends. And that, to me, is just one example of how, when we have teachers of diverse backgrounds in schools, that long-term positive effects can have on students.
Well, and speaking of subjects like math and science, still a shortage when it comes to teaching these subjects. So when it comes to teachers, does diversity take a backseat when it comes to filling these particular positions?
Well, right now it does, because there's such a desperate need for more math teachers in particular, and science as well, that many schools would just hire whoever seems to be competent and prepared. But we need to make sure that there are women and people of color in those professions, because we know it has an impact on the whole field of science and technology. And so what we've got to do, again, is start early. We can't wait till they get into college to encourage students of color who are in math and science to think about teaching as a profession.
Pedro Noguera is faculty director at UCLA Center for the Transformation of Schools. Pedro, thanks a lot for the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, staying with education, California Governor Gavin Newsom will release his first state budget proposal later this morning. But some parts of the plan have already been announced, including $40 million that would provide a second year of free tuition at community colleges. That's in addition to funding that already pays for some students' first year of school. For more on the governor's proposed college funding, we have KPCC's higher education reporter, Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Hello, Adolfo.
Good morning.
All right, now this new funding relates to a recently proposed assembly bill. What's the rationale behind it?
Well, as you know, there have been national discussions about making college free. Activists say that the effects of college debt loans are so debilitating to individuals and to our economy that we need to help students out. Some states have gone ahead and waived community college tuition, which is, in a way, is kind of like the lowest hanging fruit, because it's so much less than, you know, universities and private universities, definitely. So some community colleges in California have gone ahead and made the first and second year tuition waived already. So this is for the needy students. And last year, Sacramento did this statewide. They took the step to waive community college tuition for all first-time, full-time students. And last month, legislators proposed making the second year free.
Now, when it comes to the students that qualify for this free tuition, would this be for everyone who needs help paying for community college?
No, it would not be. And that's an important detail. It would be for all first-time, full-time students, regardless of whether you need financial aid. So that's an important detail. Now, in 2017, this population was only about 5% of the total population of California community college students. Remember, there are 2 million 2 million, not nationwide, just in California, yeah, 2 million community college students at the 113 campuses. So there are a large number of students who attend just part-time because of work and other commitments. So this benefit wouldn't affect them.
Now, when it comes to what this extra $40 million would help with students, would it help them pursue higher education and get their associate's degree at the very least? Put them on that path at least.
Right. Well, this is where activists and advocates say this move can have the broadest impact, and that is to convince students and high school graduates who are thinking about college, but who are thinking, oh, I can't afford it. It's too much money. Mm-hmm. When they hear that tuition is waived at community college the first year and the second year, they say, oh, maybe I can afford it. Maybe I can go to college. And they would go ahead, and this would motivate them to go ahead and apply for college and apply for financial aid and enroll.
Now, Adolfo, this story hits very close to home for me. I'm a community college kid, went to four of them before I went to Cal State Northridge. Free tuition is great. It's a great deal for students. But for community college kids in particular, expenses such as books, transportation, that can be a backbreaker. So what about that?
This is going to be the great debate of 2019 in higher education, this cost to attend, because for the longest time, the cost to attend has been thought of as just tuition.
Yeah.
And for a USC student, $55,000 somehow, yes, that is the biggest cost. For a UC student at $14,000 less so, Cal State student $6,000 less so, for a community college student, $1,600 a year for tuition. They spend more on gas, tuition, yep, books. And so there's a move right now statewide to help students out that way, get more money in financial aid and get more money to help them pay for these other non-tuition costs.
Adolfo Guzman Lopez is KPCC's higher education reporter. He's been talking with us about funding a second year of free community college tuition in Gavin Newsom's upcoming budget proposal. Adolfo, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, you know by now that living here in Southern California, and actually all of California, that fire season is a year-round kind of thing. That means fighting it is also a January to December process. We just heard that Gavin Newsom's going to put out his first budget today. Coming up, we're going to hear how much he's willing to spend on wildfire prevention and safety. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. It's a big day for California's new governor, Gavin Newsom. He'll be unveiling his first budget later this morning at 11. He's already signaled some big spending plans in a lot of areas, including wildfire prevention and safety. KQED's Marisa Lagos was on the road with him this week in the Northern California community of Colfax when he talked about this. Marisa, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Now, Newsom says he wants more firefighters, more mental health funding for first responders, and better technology for detecting fires. But all that will have to cost some money. So, Marisa, how much extra is Newsom proposing to get this done?
Well, he says he's going to propose about $105 million more than lawmakers actually already approved in a bill earlier at the end of last legislative session. So that bill actually took cap and trade money, $1 billion over 5 years, $200 million a year, and said we're going to spend that on things like forest management, you know, clearing brush, making sure that communities are better prepared for these fires. He's saying he's going to add another $100 million on top of that. And, you know, as you said, it's kind of for this wide range of services. and programs, expanding the Conservation Corps crews who help clear that kind of brush, new fire engines, aircraft, and that technology you mentioned, which I think is interesting because I think it shows, you know, that this governor wants to take some sort of more creative approaches to this type of problem.
Yeah, and obviously wildfires are increasing threat. It's a year-round thing for us here in California. What did Newsom say about why more money is needed now for these particular things? Things like infrared fire detection cameras, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think the state is really trying to get their arms around a problem that, quite frankly, has really become so severe in a relatively short amount of time. I mean, you've been doing this a while. 10 years ago, if one person died in a fire, it was a huge deal. If one home was burned down, you know, now we're talking almost 14,000 up in Paradise, you know, more than 80 people dead in that fire alone. And so I think that the state and Newsom is really trying to show both symbolically and substantively that they are really trying to get creative in tackling this. And, you know, I think a lot of these things, like other areas that he's going to propose today, he's saying if we make one-time investments, it's going to help us longer term, and it hopefully won't blow up the state budget if we have an economic downturn.
Well, the thing is, too, California might not get FEMA money, right? President Trump made headlines yesterday with a tweet that threatened to take away FEMA funding for wildfire victims. Prior to that, Newsom had reached out, along with several other Western governors, for more federal help. How are lawmakers reacting to that?
You know, it's been really interesting to me because I think that often you see the few Republicans left in California really between a rock and a hard place. They don't want to antagonize the president. They want to support their communities. I think this tweet really seemed to them to come out of left field. We had Congressman Doug LaMalfa basically hitting back, you know, saying he respects the president and appreciates what he's done so far around emergencies and not playing politics, and that you just can't do that. And we heard similar messages from all the state lawmakers who represent the areas hardest hit in recent years. You know, I think it's interesting. I think because Newsom was very careful during this announcement to really not sort of bait the president, I'll say. He actually defended some comments Trump had made last year when he visited Paradise with Newsom and former Governor Jerry Brown, saying that they were taken out of context when the president talked about raking forest and that, you know, how that was actually not bad. My sense, the LA Times reported that right before that tweet, Fox and Friends was talking about Newsom's inaugural address where he was not as nice to the president. So maybe that's what he was talking about. But I think it's important to note there has been no confirmation from any federal agency that a cutoff of those funds is going to happen. And it may have just been kind of a whim from our president.
But how about this, Marisa? Can Gavin Newsom do what he feels he needs to do without federal help if it's cut?
Well, I mean, the FEMA stuff, that's disaster recovery. And so that's really hitting survivors, victims, right? Squarely. What Newsom and the governors of Oregon and Washington asked for this week is something more prospective, which is they want the Federal Forest Service to have a doubling of its budget, which has been cut by $2 billion over the past 2 years. You know, the feds own 57% of the forest lands in California. The state only has 3%. And so they do need their help. Again, I am sort of not ready to say that the president's going to cut off these funds, especially considering, and this shouldn't be a consideration, but let's be clear, the people who have been hardest hit by a lot of these fires in Northern California are in red districts, which are represented by Republicans.
Now, in addition to adding the wildfire budget, the governor has said he wants to spend more on health care, more on education. Marisa, it seems like a lot at once, and I can already hear Jerry Brown's voice. One of the parting things he said was warning against overspending. How is he going to balance these promises to spend more without busting California's bank?
I mean, that's a great question. I think we are expecting to see potentially a little more optimism when it comes to the revenue projections that Newsom will put out, so maybe a little more money that his administration thinks that they can play with. I know that a lot of the proposals he's made so far are really looking at one-time infusions of cash to lay the groundwork for future expansions. And so, you know, I think what he would say is that he's trying to be responsible, investing the surplus in a way that will sort of help all Californians. But it's a real question, and I think the thing to watch politically is how the legislature responds if they still feel like they need to take that more conservative sort of approach that Jerry Brown has, or if they're just so happy to see some spending proposals that they'll take it no matter what might lie ahead.
Marisa Lagos is a political reporter at KQED. She's been following Governor Gavin Newsom's proposals to spend more on wildfire prevention in California. Marisa, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
All right, staying with government funding, for almost 3 weeks, the National Park Service and its employees have been feeling the pinch of the partial government shutdown, including Joshua Tree, which has avoided closure now that officials have decided to use park fees to keep it open. But with all this uncertainty, we wanted to see how the park and the businesses in the towns around it are being affected. The Joshua Tree area is largely dependent on tourism. For more, we have John Loredig. He's the executive director of Friends of Joshua Tree, a nonprofit that serves as a liaison for the area's rock climbers and an advocate for the park's preservation. John, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Now, the park hasn't had its usual staff of rangers during this shutdown. There's been a lot of headlines about how Joshua trees are being chainsawed and visitors are off-roading illegally. All that sounds pretty bad, John. What's your understanding of the park's condition right now?
You know, it is bad. The desert's a very sensitive environment, and that kind of damage will last for years. Joshua trees don't grow overnight, and road scars, people driving off-road, will last for decades. My understanding, I was in the park yesterday. It looks great. The volunteer cleanup efforts that have been going on the past 19 days or so really had the park looking quite nice. The Park Service staff went in yesterday to clean up, touch up, and prep the park for opening today. And, for 800,000 acres and the amount of visitors that the park saw over the holidays, upwards of 200,000, I think the park looks pretty good.
Yeah, that's good news because, those stories kind of had us all bummed out here in Los Angeles wondering, oh, my gosh,
People
from L.A. visit all the time. And to think that it was a wreck, at least that's what we thought, was kind of a bummer to hear.
Yeah, those kind of problems in the park happen sporadically. People drive off-road and trees do get damaged from time to time. It just happens that, this damage happened when the shutdown was going on and the law enforcement staff was minimal at best.
We're talking to John Reddick. He's executive director for the nonprofit Friends of Joshua Tree. Now, your organization has been doing volunteer cleanups at the park during shutdown. How long can your group keep this up? And what more maybe can be done to prevent damage from bad actors?
Boy, that's a very good question, and there's no easy answer for that. The best thing we can do is educate the public and try and make them good stewards of our public lands, whether they're, federal, state, or local. As an advocacy group for climbers, we try and send that message out to climbers all the time, especially folks that come to Joshua Tree to climb for the first time. We try and reach them and tell them the do's and don'ts of outdoor climbing.
But, John, it's got to be frustrating for you, right? Because nothing changes with the way we need to treat the park. Just because we're in a shutdown, we should still treat it with respect and with care.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The mission of the Park Service is to protect and preserve our public lands and beautiful spaces for generations to come. So if we allow, these violations to take place all the time, they have repercussions down the road, and the long-term effects of our parks will not be as great 10 years from now or a century from now.
All right, what about local businesses? How are they being affected by all this back and forth about the park potentially closing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was talking to one of the climbing guide companies yesterday, Cliffhanger Guides, and when the news first came out that the park was closed, they had to cancel reservations for people taking them guiding up into the park for climbing. And then, I think less than 36 hours later, they had to kind of reverse field and, call those people back and hope they haven't changed their plans. And the 29 Palms Chamber of Commerce was also fielding similar calls from hotels and Airbnbs, and the businesses in 29 Palms were all wondering what to do and how to mitigate this on-again, off-again situation.
John, what do you think this situation that you just mentioned, will it have a lasting economic effect on the area?
I don't think so. I think this back and forth was so fast, I'm not sure the public will have changed a whole lot of plans. But comparing this closure to the one in 2013 when the park gates were closed, the economic effect really was felt right away in the town of Joshua Tree in the high desert itself. within a few days, restaurants were laying people off.
Oh, wow.
The outdoor retailer stores were, you know, going to minimal staff. And within a week, the town was really like a ghost town.
Let's hope that doesn't happen this time around. John Loretic is executive director for the nonprofit Friends of Joshua Tree. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Consumer Electronics Show has been around for over half a century. And for the past 52 years, it's been a showcase for the latest in electronics, such as TVs, video games, cell phones, office equipment. If it needs a battery or it needs to be plugged in, you could see it at CES. Now, since cars fit that description, we've seen them there too. And now a new set of wheels rolling in as well. Find out what when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. This week, Las Vegas played host to the annual high-tech extravaganza known as Consumer Electronics Show. But it isn't all about high-def TVs and 5G. Car companies are using the show to demonstrate their latest breakthroughs in self-driving and other innovations. And this year, motorcycle makers have followed suit. Well, that's the subject of The Ride, our weekly look at personal mobility. Motor critic Sue Carpenter has been following this year's CES news, and she joins us to tell us some more about it. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
All right. Dozens of car companies were at this week's CES. Sounds like a lot. Tell me, why are so many automakers at a consumer electronics show?
Well, you just called it batteries and things that need to plug in.
Yeah,
so
true, yeah.
Because cars are essentially electronics these days, they're just computers on wheels, and most of them are owned by individuals, by consumers. There you go. But it's interesting because next week is the Detroit Auto Show, and a lot of the car companies that have opted out of that show, specifically Audi, BMW, and Mercedes, they are all at CES, and that's becoming more of a car show every year. So car companies are now using CES to show off new vehicles. That's something they've normally done at auto shows like Detroit or LA. But at this year's CES, we saw Mercedes take the wraps off its updated CLA sedan, debut an all-new electric car called the EQC, and Nissan also showed off its new Leaf E-Plus electric car that has 226 miles of range.
Wow, automakers skipping the Detroit Auto Show.
I know. Big deal.
All right, now what are some of the wilder things the automakers show this year?
How about a walking car?
That doesn't make sense.
I know. Hyundai has a car that actually sprouts legs, and I guarantee you that everything I'm about to say is not going to do this justice, so I encourage anyone who's interested to go to the Take Two website and just look for it. But basically, this Hyundai, which is called the Elevate, is a concept vehicle that can drive like a car, or it can sprout four robotic legs in place of wheels and actually walk. Granted, it walks really slowly, just three miles per hour.
That's the whole point of getting in a car. So
you're not as big as a car,
Come on.
So the idea is that a car like this can access areas that cars on wheels just can't. So especially in emergency situations, it could actually walk through a forest or over rocks, or really it's meant for disaster zones.
Now, this actually exists right now?
Not exactly. Oh, okay. If you look at their presentation, there is a little baby car being shown off by a large human. Hyundai didn't actually build the concept as a car size, but a model that is 1/8 the size. And that's what it showed, along with video and pictures of how this thing could work if and when it's ever built.
If people are thinking about it, it's probably going to happen.
I think so too.
Now, okay, that's going to be hard to beat. What else did other car makers show off?
This was cool, I thought. Audi showed off a new virtual reality experience, which is something a lot of automakers are dabbling with as they move into offering experiences, not just vehicles, especially as cars become more self-driving. So Audi now has a company called HoloRide, and that lets backseat passengers experience things like movies and video games with VR glasses. The glasses are synced up with the car, so whatever you're seeing through the glasses can incorporate the vehicle's movements. And to demonstrate this idea, Audi actually partnered with Marvel for a VR experience called something I think you would like, Avengers Rockets Rescue Run. So the VR glasses, the passenger in an Audi e-tron is in a ship that is manned by the rocket character heading through an asteroid field. It sounds super cool. I totally want to experience this.
I could be the Star-Lord of that thing. Yeah.
You could, and you'd have a really good soundtrack, I suspect. But what's different is that the car's movements are incorporated in real time. So let's just say that the car makes a hard right turn. The player curves around an opposing spaceship. Wow. If the Audi accelerates, the ship in the experience does the same thing.
All right. Now, speaking of Audi, they own the motorcycle maker Ducati. These two companies combined forces to show off a new detection technology. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it wasn't just Ducati and Audi, but also Ford is in on this. So they demonstrated a new technology that helps cars sense and react to motorcycles and hopefully reduce crashes. They call the technology vehicle to everything. Mm. So it isn't just motorcycles that cars can detect and react to and avoid hitting, but pedestrians and other objects. That is a super huge breakthrough, since a lot of these semi-autonomous features in cars, like pedestrian detection and blind spot monitoring, they have a really hard time detecting two-wheelers, especially ones that are moving as fast as motorcycles.
So how does something like that work?
With sensors. So a lot of cars these days have all kinds of sensors, radar, cameras built into them. This technology incorporates those sensors into motorcycles. So the vehicles can communicate with each other wirelessly, and they know where they're at in relation to one another.
All right. So Ducati, not the only motorcycle company showing off new technology. We've got two others.
We do. BMW showed off a self-driving motorcycle. Wow. It actually had a motorcycle ride across a parking lot in Las Vegas without anyone on it, which had a lot of motorcyclists like me asking why something like this even needs to exist. The thing is, BMW is doing this as a demonstration of technology that already exists on cars. So things like adaptive cruise control to help keep riders safe. They're not actually planning to make a self-driving vehicle.
And real quick, Harley too?
Oh my gosh, yeah, Harley Davidson. They showed off three electric motorcycles. Most people don't associate Harley with electrics at all, but they're LiveWire. This is something that they first trotted out 5 years ago. It's going into production this August for about $30,000. And then they showed off two electric concepts. So this is a huge turning point for the motorcycle industry.
That would change Sons of Anarchy. You wouldn't get that rumbling that, you know.
Yeah.
Take two, Sue Carpenter, talking about all the technology car and motorcycle makers are showing off at this week's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Sue, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9. Air Talk with Larry Mantle is coming up next. Hey, Larry.
You'd be impressed. I lost track of time. I made it in 10 seconds.
I know.
Lightning quick. You like the Flash? Well, yeah. I'm Larry Flash. I couldn't believe I got here that fast. As for what's on the show, we're also going to talk about CES and some of the more entertaining gadgets from there. And Gavin Newsom will be introducing his proposed budget at 11 o'clock. We'll talk about some of the major proposals that are in that budget.
All right, that's Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10 o'clock.
Let me see if I can beat my time going back.